This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
The abuse of Kenyan civilians by the police is on the rise, according to the Independent Police Oversight Authority.
That's Mohammed Yusuf reporting from Nairobi. Details coming up. Also, a banker implicated in the embezzlement and money laundering case against Isabel dos Santos has been found dead in Lisbon. And top diplomats from Libya's neighboring countries and beyond meet in the Algerian capital today, trying to end the conflict in Libya. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Today, the courts in Angola charged Isabela dos Santos, the daughter of former Angolan president José Eduardo dos Santos, with money laundering and mismanagement, charges linked to her time overseeing the state oil company. Dos Santos is estimated to be worth over $2 billion and claims she is a self-made woman who never benefited from state funds. She denies the allegations against her and says they are politically motivated. For the latest on the matter, we have in studio João José Santarita from VOA's Portuguese to Africa service. Welcome to Africa News Tonight.
Thank you for having me.
João, let's start with the latest. A banker implicated in the embezzlement and money laundering case against Isabel dos Santos has been found dead in Lisbon.
Yeah, it's true. The police say there's no suspicion of foul play. They say it was suicide. From our context there, we gather that this is tragic, obviously, that Mr. Nuno Ribeiro da Cunha was found hanged in his house, apparently a suicide. Now, he was a manager in an Eurobic bank. This is a bank in which Isabel dos Santos had about a 40% share, and which two or three days before he committed suicide said that it had decided to cut all ties with Isabel dos Santos' companies. The bank was used for a lot of investments in Isabel dos Santos' companies, and presently was being investigated for the transfer of money from the oil company to an account in Dubai. And also there is a suspicion about a transfer of about $28 million or an attempted transfer to a bank in the Isle of Man. So this man unfortunately committed suicide. Now, I have to say that police sources in Portugal, they don't know obviously why the man killed himself, but they did say that he had tried to kill himself about a week and a half ago. So it might not be related to this, but it's undoubtedly suspicious.
It's very suspicious, yes. So, João, what specifically is Ms. dos Santos accused of?
Well, the Attorney General, I must say here that the Angolan judicial system has a stage before there is a formal indictment. And this stage is when they name people and say they are now subject of a criminal investigation. So it's a step short of an indictment with a court. But basically what the Attorney General says is that she and three other people are now subject of a criminal investigation for money laundering, falsification of documents, and mismanagement. Falsification of documents has to do, again, with the Sonangol Oil Company and the transfer of money to Dubai companies associated with Isabel dos Santos. Sure. So these are the indictments. The Attorney General of Angola is now in Portugal because Portugal was a big center for the operations of Isabel dos Santos. I must say that one of the people that was indicted in Angola with her is a gentleman by the name of Mario Leite da Silva. And he was a manager in a bank called Banco de Fomento de Angola, BFA, and he's just resigned from that post. And there's another, again, the circle is tightening now, definitely. There's another Portuguese citizen, Jaime Esteves. He has resigned from these top world companies, an auditing and financial advisor company called the PwC. It's one of the world's biggest companies for auditing and financial advice. And he has resigned. He was the manager for the account for Angola, and he dealt with Isabel dos Santos companies. And he has resigned after the company announced that it is doing an internal auditing about the activities with Isabel. So the circle is tightening, and of course now we have the first tragedy.
So PwC is the PricewaterhouseCoopers?
Exactly.
And also we have a Boston consulting group, McKinsey & Company as well. I mean, the net is so wide.
This Boston company is one of the companies that is, for lack of a better word, accused of being involved in advising Isabel dos Santos companies. I think they also announced, I'm not sure now, if they are suspending all dealings with Isabel dos Santos companies, but definitely the circle is tightening. Now, the Attorney General of Angola, who is now in Lisbon, I think he must be meeting now with the Attorney General in Portugal, has said that one of the things that they're going to discuss is the possibility of freezing Isabel dos Santos and her company's assets in Lisbon. But of course, he says that what's in the news, it's not valid in court. So they must have very strong proof of malfeasance before they can ask the Portuguese courts to freeze her assets. But I think definitely this is now what they're discussing.
So Ms. Dos Santos reportedly owns $55 million mansion in Monte Carlo, a $35 million yacht, and a luxury residence in Dubai. With this kind of lavish lifestyle, Ms. Dos Santos and her husband could face years in prison if convicted, according to the office of the Angolan president. You think this will ever materialize?
Well, I think it's going to be extremely difficult because, a lot of these dealings, they were authorized by the president. So a lot of this money that went from the Angolan government to her daughter and her husband, are going to be very difficult to make this into a criminal case. Her husband said on VOA that might be illegal in the United States, but it's not illegal in Angola. So it's going to be very difficult. Now, there are cases where there are indications of, irregularities. And this is where the Angolan government is going to have proof so that they can go after her assets overseas and probably ask for her arrest and be sent to Angola. But I think that's going to be very difficult.
We will be talking about this story for a long time, João. Thank you, João, from VOA's Portuguese to Africa service. Thank you for your input, sir.
Thank you.
Top diplomats from Libya's neighboring countries and beyond meet in the Algerian capital today, trying to end the conflict tearing apart the oil-rich North African country. The meeting includes foreign ministers from Egypt, Sudan, Chad, Niger, Algeria, Tunisia, and Mali. All but Mali border Libya, and all have suffered fallout from the fighting between Libya's UN-backed leadership based in Tripoli and the eastern-based forces led by General Khalifa Haftar. World powers are pushing both sides to respect a tentative truce. In Berlin, foreign powers active in Libya agreed to shore up a shaky ceasefire, but the meeting was overshadowed by Haftar's blockade of oil fields. Haftar's forces, which control the east and much of the south, received support from the United Arab Emirates and Egypt, as well as France and Russia. The Tripoli-based government is backed by Turkey and, to a lesser degree, Qatar and Italy. The killing of a Nigerian priest by Boko Haram militants has raised fresh concerns among Nigeria's Christian community that it is being targeted by the Islamist militants. The death came barely 2 weeks after President Muhammadu Buhari urged Nigerians to stop viewing acts of terror as a religious war. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
The Reverend Lawan Andimi was declared missing January 3rd after Boko Haram insurgents raided his village in Mitika in northeastern state of Adamawa. He headed the state's chapter of the Christian governing body, Christian Association of Nigeria, CAN. The insurgents murdered him on Monday while negotiations for his release were ongoing, an event that has triggered widespread criticisms of the government by the Christian body. Security analyst Ebenezer Oyetakin says the killing was intended to incite religious tensions between the two major religious groups in the country.
The Muslim and the Christians in Nigeria and the citizens must know that the instrument these external forces and their internal collaborators are exploiting are our fault lines of tribes, religion, and ethnicity. So, the Nigerian people should unite against them. I personally, as a Christian, I do not see the killing of the Khan chairman in Adamawa as a target against Christians. It is a target against the nation exploiting our fault line.
Boko Haram often holds some captives on the basis of their faith while setting others free. The Christian Association of Nigeria, CAN, accuses authorities of not doing enough to secure the release of abducted Christians. Security expert Senator Irebu shares that opinion.
You cannot lie that Christians are not targeted, because that's the reality. And you will say they should not stop complaining, because that's the reality. If CAN chairman is kidnapped, if terrorists abduct people and segregate Christians and held them captive, you won't say it's not there. Is there. So what are you doing to ensure that this set of people are not vulnerable to this kind of terrorist onslaught?
Oyetakin says concerns about religious tensions can be avoided if the government was more proactive.
The government must govern in such a way that regenerates a bond of national unity.
Earlier this month, President Muhammadu Buhari urged Nigerians to stop seeing acts of terrorism as a religious war. On Tuesday, he reacted to the killing of a priest using his official social media account. The president said he was, I quote, greatly saddened by the fact that the terrorists went on to kill him, even while giving signals of willingness to set him free by releasing him to third parties. This barbarism is condemnable. We will ensure that these terrorists pay a heavy price for their actions, end quote. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. A day after opposition leader Nelson Chamisa addressed his followers in Harare's oldest suburb, violence erupted between young supporters of the ruling ZANU-PF and youth members of the opposition movement for democratic change. Reporter Kuzai Zenawashi has more.
Members of the Movement for Democratic Change, or MDC, wound up trapped in a police station Wednesday after a clash broke out between members of the ruling ZANU-PF and MDC members. MDC Councillor Godfrey Kura Uwone says ZANU-PF members attacked first.
Yesterday, around 9 a.m., some ZANU-PF people in Bari, mostly youth, they besieged an MDC base in Bari, where there was an MDC flag. They tried to pull down the MDC flag at the same time, displacing people who were there that day. They attacked MDC members who were there.
He says MDC's efforts to resolve the violence proved useless.
When these guys went to police to report, unfortunately, they're the ones who got arrested and they were put gun bars. So when we went there, trying to understand why they arrest the complainants, I think that's when they started mobilizing people from all over Harare, and they come and gathered at the Matari police station and were trapped inside the police station.
He says that police did not intervene, and the suspected ZANU-PF youths were wielding weapons such as axes and machetes. Kura Uwone says they were outnumbered, and it was hours later before other MDC members could rescue them from the police station. ZANU-PF leaders, however, say the violence began with MDC youth. Tendai Chirau is the ZANU-PF secretary for administration.
The facts on the ground reflect that our membership booked to conduct a cleanup campaign in Mbare, and as they were cleaning up, they were clad with their regalia, and there were some elements within the opposition who started throwing missiles at them, and this resulted in about three of them getting injured. And that's when the violence began. We as a party, we are of the view for peaceful existence. The architect of this violence is the opposition. We call for peaceful coexistence.
Efforts to reach police for comment have been fruitless, but they are quoted in the local media as saying the matter is under investigation. Tulani Mselando is with a pro-democracy organization called Crisis in Zimbabwe Coalition.
We are of the view that violence has no place in modern democratic societies, or at least those that seek to be democratic. In our view, the deep structural issues around the country's political culture continue to undermine prospects for democratic development. We urge parties to refrain from violence towards other parties and the media.
As Zimbabwe's economy continues to decline and the cost of living increases, tensions are high as frustration increases for those struggling to provide for their families. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinalashe from Harare.
The Zimbabwean government has proposed a constitutional amendment that critics say is aimed at consolidating President Emmerson Mnangagwa's power. Addie Gando gives us more on the matter.
The proposed amendment has a number of clauses which critics say are contentious, such as the removal of the running mate provision. The running mate clause, which is set to take effect from the 2023 general election, is poised to fall away should the gazetted bill become law. Under the current clause, the president and his deputies were meant to be jointly elected to office. This means a deputy would become an elected official, so firing him or her would be an onerous task. The late president, Robert Mugabe, fired the then vice president, Mnangagwa, at the height of the ZANU-PF succession fight. Observers say Mnangagwa appears to be seeking the same instrument that was used to expel him. Love Momaduku of the National Constitutional Assembly, which is part of the Political Actors Dialogue Pollard platform, says the group's members charge that they were not consulted and that the bill is an affront to the spirit of constitutionalism.
Must not be allowed. We oppose it on procedure. The constitution must not be simply amended at the instance of the ruling party or the government of the day. Procedurally, that is wrong. Regardless of what they are putting in.
Observers say the bill is a power play intended at helping Mnangagwa deal with internal resistance in the event of a succession challenge within his own party, ZANU-PF. Opposition member of parliament, Kutsatsa Pulu, who is responsible for constitutional affairs in the main opposition party, MDC, says the proposal is retrogressive.
Most of the amendments, if you look at them, they reduce accountability. These amendments are horrendous, and they wind us back to a pre-2013 position. What the government has done is that they've really said they want to rubbish the 2013 constitution, and they're moving away from democracy more and more.
Another contentious clause would allow judges of the Constitutional Court and Supreme Court to extend their tenure each year after reaching age 70 for up to 5 years, subject to a favorable medical report. The president has sole discretion to renew the judge's tenure, which critics say compromises the impartiality of the judiciary. Maduku weighs in.
Giving more and more and more power to the president, they are concentrating power in the hands of the president. For example, why would you simply increase the AGMA judges from 70 to 75 and then say that every year you will be submitting a certificate to the president? Then he is one who accepts whether you are in good condition or not. Isn't that giving the president control over the judiciary?
Human rights lawyer Doug Cotter sees the amendment as an assault on the spirit of the constitution, which more than 93% of the electorate approved.
This is purely an egotistical endeavor to consolidate power. It has nothing to do with the people and is a very, very dangerous precedent that within such a short space of time, our constitution is being amended without ever actually being properly implemented and being amended in such a way that that really destroys a lot of the key reforms that the constitution sought to bring about.
The bill is set to be debated in parliament in April. In the meantime, parliament is obliged to start public consultations on the proposal in public meetings and through written submissions. Justice, Legal and Parliamentary Affairs Minister Ziyambi Ziyambi confirmed that public consultations will take place before the bill goes through parliament. Reporting for VOA, this is Addie Gondo.
Kenya's Independent Policing Oversight Authority, IPOA, says Police abuse of civilians is getting worse and includes extrajudicial killings and enforced disappearances. The IPOA issued a report Wednesday documenting over 3,000 cases of abuse by Kenyan police, mostly in poor slum areas. Mohammed Yusuf has the story from Nairobi.
17-year-old Stephen Macharusi was buried Thursday in Molo, a town in the Rift Valley region. He was killed in the Kasarani area of Nairobi during protests over bad roads. Medical examination showed he was shot at close range, and family members are blaming police. His sister spoke to VOA after the burial.
We went just for a brother. That's why I want to come to Nairobi to follow up the story. People that I have, of course, will get justice. I'm very sure of that. We won't rest until we get justice for our brother.
The abuse of Kenyan civilians by the police is on the rise, according to the Independent Police Oversight Authority, a body mandated to check on the work of the police. 3,200 people reported cases of police abuse in 2019. That is six times the number of people who reported police abuse in 2013. The chairperson of IPOA, Anne Makori, spoke about the findings.
IPOA has noted with a lot of concern that the misuse of firearm and use of excessive force continue to be the biggest challenge facing the National Police Service.
The report by IPOA comes days after Macharusi and Hemedi Majini, another teenager, were allegedly shot by police. Both incidents took place in Nairobi. The Human Rights Watch Global Report 2020 said Kenyan authorities used force to disperse protesters, and 21 people were killed with no justification. The New York-based group said Kenyan authorities have failed to hold officers accountable. It said that in June 2019, prosecutors presented 67 cases of police abuse to the courts, but only six resulted in convictions. Otisiano Namoaya is a rights group researcher in Kenya. He says police often try to conceal evidence of wrongdoing by officers.
Police are supposed to provide preliminary report and share that report with the Inspector General, the Internal Affairs Unit of the police, and the IPOA. And then the IPOA picks it up from there. But police never do this. They don't provide information. They try to destroy evidence as much as possible. They go out of their way to intimidate witnesses.
Doreen Muthaura of IPOA agrees witness intimidation has hampered efforts to get convictions.
The challenge is actually witnesses coming forth now for purposes of recording statements. You know, the threshold of some of the cases that we're investigating is beyond reasonable doubt. Therefore, if we don't have witnesses, we don't have a watertight case, and the prosecution or any action, including disciplinary action, cannot be taken against those officers.
An official on the police force told VOA it is not the place of the force to critique the work of IPOA, instead to support it so that it can discharge its duties. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
The World Health Organization is welcoming China's decision to temporarily suspend all transportation in and out of the city of Wuhan, the epicenter of the coronavirus outbreak. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said that placing the Chinese city of 11 million under virtual quarantine was a strong but appropriate measure. Governments in Africa, including Nigeria, South Sudan, Uganda, and Mozambique, are beginning to screen travelers from China. More than 500 cases of the coronavirus have been confirmed, with at least 17 deaths since the virus appeared last month in Wuhan, China. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the sunny side of sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nashwan Kali, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.